Sponsorship of the KQED live audio stream comes from Xfinity Mobile, featuring customized wireless plans. Customers can choose unlimited, buy the gig, shared data, or a mix of both and switch it up anytime. Learn more at xfinitymobile.com.
The first thing I'd like to do is introduce our moderator, Yumi Wilson. Yumi is a professor of journalism at the San Francisco State University, and she's an active member of our board of directors here at USF, the Criminal Justice Institute. She's been a friend of mine since 2003 when she moderated several of the mayoral debates, and she brings a fresh and non-biased outlook, and I greatly appreciate the fact that she's participating and will be moderating this debate. So I'll turn it over to her at this time, and let's give her a big round of applause.
Just a little bit more about me. I'm also a former reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle for 11 years, and that is essentially, I guess, how I got my job as a journalism professor. So I am a practitioner. So welcome to our noontime discussion on gang injunctions. As probably most of you are aware of, gang injunctions have been in the news quite a bit. And just for full disclosure, I am a producer for KALW 91.7. And in a few weeks, we hope to have Jeff and John. Thank you. A little shorter, join us for a program on gang injunctions. So we are fortunate today to have Oakland City Attorney John Russo and San Francisco Public Defender Jeff Adachi. Both will be offering us very different perspectives on gang injunctions, which have been used in California since the 1980s. As an effective but controversial weapon in the fight against crime. The goal of civil injunctions is to disrupt illegal activities before they become serious or violent crimes, according to prosecutors and police. Los Angeles, Long Beach, San Jose, Modesto, San Francisco, and Oakland are among the dozens of cities in California and elsewhere that are going to court and winning injunctions, restraining orders, against certain gangs. In Los Angeles, the police department defines the gang injunction as, quote, a civil suit that seeks a court order declaring the gang's public behavior a nuisance and asking for special rules directed toward its activity. Injunctions can address the neighborhood's gang problem before it reaches the level of felony crime activity. This is according to the police department website for Los Angeles. Certain studies done at the academic level have shown that injunctions can be, quote, effective in reducing the level of serious crime. And this particular academic study was done of Los Angeles. In Oakland, the gang injunction, as I understand, works somewhat differently, in fact, quite differently. Under City Attorney John Russo, the gang injunction goes after certain individuals within gangs. Russo's office says it has tried to take every precaution, in fact, working with ACLU and other civil rights members to ensure individual rights as it goes after the most violent gang offenders. But public defenders, community activists, and ACLU officials say and maintain that gang injunctions don't work, and they give police, quote, too much discretion to harass and target young men of color, even those who aren't gang members. Do court injunctions serve as an effective way to battle gang-related crime? At what point does a community's desire for safety outweigh an individual's rights to gather? Are there any other alternatives to court injunctions? Should there be? Offering us opposing views of gang injunctions and their use as a weapon against crime are Jeff Adachi and John Russo. Just a little intro. Jeff Adachi was elected San Francisco Public Defender in March 2002. Before that, he worked as a deputy public defender in San Francisco for 15 years and in private practice for 2 years. From 1998 to 2001, Adachi served as the chief attorney of the office. He has tried over 100 jury trials, including numerous serious felony and homicide cases, and has handled over 3,000 criminal matters throughout his career, including some of the Bay Area's high-profile cases. Adachi graduated from Hastings College of the Law in 1985 and attended undergraduate studies at UC Berkeley. John Russo graduated with honors in economics and political science from Yale University and earned his law degree from New York University School of Law. In June 1994, John was elected to the Oakland City Council. In 2000, John became Oakland's first elected city attorney and was re-elected in 2004. He may have some other parts of the bio that he would like to share, maybe not. Just as Jeff would. Both of you, by the way, I got these bios from your websites. So thank you. Love the internet for that. So what I thought I would do is to really start off what I hope is much more of a discourse and perhaps even a debate, because I do think from reading all of the different articles and studies for myself, I did find very different views, and I really hope that we have a hearty discussion for the next 45 minutes or so. What I thought I would do is have each of you come up, and I would like to start with John, because there is a lot of heat, per se, on the Oakland City Attorney in terms of what he's been doing, which I find somewhat interesting given Los Angeles and numerous other cities have been doing similar things, and have John kind of talk about what he's been doing in Fruitvale, North Oakland, and give us kind of a summary, if you could. And then I would like Jeff to respond to Oakland, and then perhaps maybe a broader context. At that point, if you want to, in terms of technical stuff, I think the podium is great when you take that stand. And then once you are up here, feel free to sit on either side. And I will get out of your way, starting with John. And if you guys both want to come up, I've got lots of questions based on the articles that are out there.
Well, good afternoon. Yumi, thank you very much. And thank you to USF for the opportunity to be here. Thanks for honoring me to allow me to close your symposium. Delighted to have this opportunity to speak with you. My guess is that by the time I'm done, I'll probably have made everybody annoyed, which seems to be my special talent in trying to deal with issues in a way that, at least from my perspective, as an Oakland, longtime Oakland resident and Oakland elected official, tries to actually deal with issues as they exist, not as we wish they were. Our injunction in Oakland is the most civil rights and due process oriented gang injunction in the history of the state of California, might be the best in that regard in the nation. The irony is that, and of course it's not so much an irony, but it's ironic that it has been so controversial in Oakland. In fact, I suspect in our discussion today, you will find less debate between Jeff and me than you will find discussion. In fact, I consulted with Jeff at the outset of the first North Oakland injunction, as I consulted with the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights, as I consulted with ACLU, as I consulted with the Ella Baker Center, and most of the other folks who throughout my career, because I spent 6 years on the Oakland City Council before my 10 years as city attorney, this is the first issue I've ever been on the other side from those folks. I've always been much more sort of a civil libertarian. Oakland's been late to the game in gang injunctions. Gang injunctions have been at work, I believe, largely effectively, at work throughout California since the late 1980s. There's no issue about their constitutionality as passed. That was decided by the court in 1997 regarding a San Jose injunction in the Acuna case. Now, I've always been very skeptical of gang injunctions, and that's part of why Oakland has been so late. We did not file our first injunction until February of last year, 2009, against an outfit called NSO, Northside Oakland. Now, one of the issues is that the state law is called the Street Gang Act. And so people start thinking about gangs as groupings that have colors and symbols and tags and that sort of thing. Or if they're foolish and living in a fantasy world, they think about the Sharks and the Jets. That's not what we're dealing with. The statute defines it as a group of individuals acting in concert to create a nuisance in the community. It's an ongoing criminal enterprise. So I want to talk first about the North Oakland injunction, which the court granted to us in June of 2010. NSO Northside Oakland, for those of you who are devotees of mob films, and I can raise it since I am Italian, you can't. Those of you who are devotees, Northside Oakland is not so much a gang. Northside Oakland is more a non-aggression pact of different crews. So use the term crews, guys who were dealing illegal narcotics and pursuing extortion rackets on different corners throughout North Oakland, who had been fighting with each other going all the way back to 2001 after the assassination of some drug kingpin in West Oakland. They developed this non-aggression pact where they carved up a large part of North Oakland, sort of saying, you take that corner, we'll take this corner, we'll take these corners, you stay out of ours, we'll stay out of yours. And so the slogan for NSO is they refer to North Oakland as the North Pole, because everybody's cool in the North Pole. And you'll see NSO tattoos, you'll see NSO tags, but they're not a gang the way you would think about, say, the Crips and the Bloods, to use sort of the iconic Southern California gangs from 20 and 25 years ago. Our injunction against NSO, a little different than most gang injunctions throughout the state, we bring an action to prove the existence of the gang. We also, and it costs us much more work up front, we bring the injunction against each specific individual against whom we intend to apply the injunction. The courts find by clear and convincing evidence, which is higher than preponderance of the evidence that you would get in a normal civil case, not as high as beyond a reasonable doubt, but by clear and convincing evidence, the court needs to find that the individual we have named is not just a bad guy with a long rap sheet who is a pain in the neck to the community and maybe much worse. They have to find that he's also part of the ongoing criminal enterprise, which is acting as a nuisance in the community. So let's walk through a member of NSO. He has to be found and served with notice of his hearing. He is entitled to a hearing in court. By the way, the Alameda County Public Defender attended the hearings regarding Northside Oakland, but is convinced that what we are doing by going against individuals sufficiently protects civil rights that they're not participating now in the Norteño's injunction, which we are in court for again today. So these 15 individuals in North Oakland, they get served with process. We have to find them. We have to serve them. They get their day in court, or in the case of the Norteño's, we are now in day 8 of a preliminary injunction hearing with no end in sight, which is fine. That's what we wanted, a true due process injunction. After the court has its hearing, if the court finds that this individual is in fact part of the gang and should be subject to the injunction, then we have to go find the guy again and serve him with the injunction paper itself. So I want to give you one anecdote in North Oakland. 15 guys. Court held for all 15, for the city regarding all 15. 13 of them, we managed to serve the actual injunction papers. What does the injunction do? In effect, it's a curfew. You're not allowed out on the street between 10 p.m. and 5 a.m. You're not allowed out on the street in the safety zone at any time with another person who's been enjoined, not just anybody, but another enjoined person, so that you can't terrorize the community. You can't have graffiti tools, you can't be near them, you can't have drugs, you can't be near them, you can't have weapons, you can't be near them. Stuff that is usually conditions of probation for a lot of these fellas anyway. So 13 guys we find, two of them we can't find to serve them with the actual order, the court order. That sounds bad, but maybe not so bad, because it's the officers who are devoted to North Oakland who are out there. We don't have a special go find the gang guy who's out there. So we figured they're not on the street, so that kind of works, right? Well, not really, because in October, a fellow named Eric Tullis, one of the two we couldn't find, was hanging out around midnight on a Friday night, and he was out there with two other fellas, and sure enough, drive-by happens, and Tullis is hit, critically injured. He's recovered now, but he's in ICU. Another fella hit, critically wounded, ICU. He's recovered. Third guy hit, critically wounded, dies. That's bad enough. A young woman named Carolyn Howard, 29 years old, who had just moved to Oakland a couple of months earlier, was getting in her car. She didn't know any of these guys. New to the neighborhood. Getting in her car, she was going out clubbing. And she gets hit with a stray bullet, and she's dead. And she's not the first in that neighborhood. We had a 17-year-old gal 5 months before we filed the injunction, which was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back for our Neighborhood Crime Prevention Council members. 17-year-old Katrina survivor, who was standing next to a member of NSO, and someone took a shot at him but missed and hit her and killed her. We've had two others in the last 2 years, also innocent bystanders, had nothing to do with the gang. One was a 27-year-old film editor in his car, who got sideswiped and killed, a 42-year-old gentleman who was then run over by the sideswiped car. These are folks who have nothing to do with the gang life, but they live in our neighborhoods or they work in our neighborhoods, and they are in danger because the people who are in the gangs are not just shooters, they're also targets. And unfortunately, the young men who have many too many weapons on their hands and much too much anger are not only prolific with their shots, they are not very good shots. And so many innocent bystanders are hit. That's what we're fighting about. I can't tell you how we could have made an injunction more responsive to due process than to force Oakland Police Department, which was not happy about this, but it was the only way to get my sign off, to bring these injunctions individual by individual and have a court determine in advance that the injunction should be levied against those individuals. The police in Oakland do not have discretion to enforce the injunction. They must enforce the injunction only against the individuals against whom we have a court order. So there is no discretion, which means there's no profiling and there's no fear of profiling. And finally, I did that in part because I'm the city attorney and I have to defend the cases against OPD. And I knew if we went with injunctions, given the way Oakland is, our culture in Oakland, if we implemented gang injunctions without having court orders in advance, we would have a plethora of suits against us claiming, maybe correctly or maybe not, claiming profiling and claiming a violation of civil rights. So we are spending the money up front to do this in a way that preserves due process and civil rights. Nevertheless, we have folks who, in Oakland, some, the media loves them, no knock, Yumi, but, you know, if there isn't a conflict, it won't be in the papers, and there are no facts anymore, it seems, in journalism. It's not these fellas were arrested for these problems. It is Russo contends they were arrested and convicted. Go check the records. There ought to be a fact somewhere in these stories, not just he says, gravity works. She says we all float in space. You decide. There are no facts anymore. So this issue should not be an issue. The Oakland injunction should not be controversial to anybody who is concerned about civil rights and concerned about due process. But it is because we do have many people in Oakland who still are arguing over whether Trotsky or Stalin was right. And those folks don't like the police, and they don't like injunctions no matter what. And you can argue all you like, but facts are irrelevant. It is a triumph of ideology over facts. That's what our injunction is about. We are currently, and then I'll wrap, we are currently pursuing an injunction against the Norteños gang, which is much more a traditional gang with colors and its own catechism and its own recruitment mechanism, including in the prisons. We are bringing that injunction against 40 specific individuals. The court is now on its eighth day of deliberations. We anticipate at least two more. There is no one who can walk away from that process and say that these individuals were not given their day in court and due process. So that's how we've evolved the gang injunction in Oakland. I think it's a better way to do it. It protects against what I think are legitimate concerns about profiling, and we believe they are very effective. We know they've been effective in North Oakland. When we get the injunction in the Fruitvale, we're going to make that neighborhood safer as well, and I welcome the heat. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I am too very honored to be here. I think I'm probably the only public defender here. No? Well, actually, John and I have been friends for many, many years, and it's true. We were having lunch, and he said, you know what? I think I'm going to undertake gang injunctions in Oakland. What do you think? And I told him what I thought. He probably knew what I was going to say, and obviously he didn't follow my advice. But for him to do, for John to do what he did, took a tremendous amount of guts and some cojones, let me tell you. It's not an easy thing to do, particularly in the Bay Area. And one of the things I told him is that no matter what you say or do, you're going to be criticized. You're going to be criticized. It doesn't matter. And when he says the facts don't matter, they really don't, because it's sort of a circular argument. And having been involved in this debate for a long time, I can honestly say that there are so many different ways that you can cut and slice this issue. I could come up here and tell you every reason, you know, under the Constitution and our civil liberties why gang injunctions are not a good idea. You probably heard all these arguments before or have read them, so I don't know whether that really takes us any place different. And what I'm hoping to come out of here with is a better understanding of how we can solve the gang problem. Because one thing that is undeniable is that we have a terrible, destructive gang problem in our communities. And unless we find an approach that works or that reduces the violence, we are lost. We truly are. And when we talk about gang injunctions, we tend to talk about it as a philosophy, as opposed to a tool, in isolation, in a vacuum, that it's either good or it's bad. It either works or it doesn't work. It's either a cure-all for everything or it's a disaster for everything. And it tends to be a very polarized discussion. And those of you who work on the streets, who have worked, in gang suppression and even gang intervention work, know that that's not the reality, that the gang problem is as complex, it is as difficult to pigeonhole even a gang member and what a gang member is. I mean, we have our legal definition, but you know that gangs come in all different shapes, sizes, and colors, and variations. And you can't simply paint all gangs with the same brush. I mean, the reality is that we have had gangs since probably the beginning of time, at least here in San Francisco, right? The Sydney Ducks, a group of ex-cons from Australia, came to San Francisco in the 1850s and raised holy hell. nearly burned down a good part of the city. And that was a gang injunction of sort. They went out, they had a vigilante group, it was called the San Francisco Vigilantes, and they rounded everybody out and they hung them. Right, that was a form of a gang injunction, I guess. You go back into the 1950s, and there's a great film, and it's part of the National Archives, but it's called Youth Gangs in San Francisco. And it's just a guy who went out there with the camera. It's very it was shot in film, but they went all over the city and just filmed gang members. And at the time in San Francisco, they had something like 120 gangs, and they didn't try to hide who they were. They had names like the Young Warriors, the Hawaiians, and they all had jackets. And not all gangs were involved in criminal activity, but many were. And at the time, they declared that there was going to be a gang epidemic in San Francisco because you had all of these kids who were hanging out and basically doing nothing and causing trouble. And one of the solutions that came out of that era was to create a youth service organization. It's called YSA. And they would take these kids and they'd bring them out to places like Hetch Hetchy. I didn't know this. You go out to Hetch Hetchy, see the dam there, but the bridges that were needed to keep Hetch Hetchy running were built by these kids, and they would take these kids out there and teach them how to build bridges. So it's very interesting to look at how our city, our community, the Bay Area, has dealt with the gang problem, over time. Now, there's a huge distinction, as John pointed out, between a group of young people who are, it doesn't have to be young people, who are hanging out together. That is our natural state, to be together, right? I mean, you are all together today. We had a public defender convention, the public defenders get together. We all tend to bond together in our own groups and for our own purpose. And it wouldn't be any different from a group that was from a particular neighborhood or even groups that are engaged in common criminal activity are naturally going to bind together and be together, right? We have our best practices, they have theirs. And part of the reality, I think, of understanding how to combat gangs, and I'm not an expert, is to recognize that you're not necessarily going to discourage people from hanging out together. And I'm not saying that that's the purpose of what a gang injunction is. I had an interesting conversation with New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg, and I was very interested about the New York approach. And, you can't compare New York to, Los Angeles or San Francisco or anywhere else, but there's a report that did. And this is by the Justice Policy Institute. And they talked about how New York and Los Angeles had very different approaches. And my apologies to anyone here from Los Angeles who may have a different view, but this is what the report said. Since 1955, they took city resources and federally funded programs involving primarily street work and gang intervention programs. And they're grounded in primarily social work, as what they call soft law enforcement, neighborhood youth councils working directly with City Hall. And so this has been a tradition in New York for, nearly 50 years. In Los Angeles, the focus has been on gang suppression, the idea of, law enforcement eliminating the structure of gangs to discourage the formation of gangs and the existence of gangs to begin with. And some of the things that were cited in this study were, using a gang database, which is an effective way of categorizing people who are involved in gangs, arresting gang members, separating gang members, using mobile booking centers, using the broken window theory in arresting gang members for minor offenses with the idea that it would, if you didn't do that, it would lead to more serious offenses, surveillance, sweeps, and enforcement of gang laws. In New York, they don't have any gang injunctions at all. No gang injunctions. They do not use gang injunctions. In Los Angeles, the first civil gang injunction was sought in 1987. And today, there are 37 gang injunctions in Los Angeles, encompassing 57 gangs and over 11,000 gang members. And the most recent numbers, and I may be incorrect about this, is about in 26 and 30,000 gang members, but I think the study is a couple years old, so it may be even more than that. If you look at the violent crime per residence, New York is somewhat lower, but not extremely much lower. It's 381 per 100,000, and for Los Angeles, it's 482. Interestingly enough, both Los Angeles and New York have experienced drops in violent crime. And in the case of New York, a 10-year drop was 41%. In Los Angeles, it was 22.4%. Over an 18-year period in New York, you had an 88.4% drop in violent crime. Now, so both cities have seen drops. New York has seen a greater drop in violent crime. One big difference is that if you look at the number of gang-related crimes in Los Angeles, there were 23,000 verified violent gang crimes, including 784 homicides, 12,000 felony assaults, 10,000 robberies, and just under 500 rapes. And again, if you look at New York, I mean, that number is much, much smaller. Now, that could be attributable to the fact that they do not, in the same way, classify crime as being gang-related crime. But anywhere you cut it, even if you looked at their stats for violent crime in these categories, New York has a very small percentage of crimes that would be considered gang or gang-related or related to that kind of activity. Since Los Angeles has put the gang injunctions in place, there's been an increase, a doubling of gang members. Now, that doesn't mean that the gang injunctions created that. It's just an indicator of whether gang injunctions have served to reduce the number of gangs, if that argument could be made. In New York, their philosophy of fighting gangs, and this is what the mayor told me. He said, we do not believe in eliminating gangs. We believe in eliminating violence. So in New York, because New York is a very densely populated area, they have used interventionists to work in the areas where gangs are most prevalent. The idea there is that by using former gang members and using social workers to reduce the violence when that's possible, that they are able to better negotiate through retaliatory violence. There's always a certain degree of violence that occurs, but where we're losing the battle is when it's coming to the retaliation, when it's going back and forth, and that's when innocent people are being killed, and that's when you have a proliferation of violence. And certainly we've seen that here in San Francisco. Now, we do have social programs in San Francisco. We have a lot of them. We have a lot of gang intervention groups. And one thing that I often say to them is you rarely hear a leader from a gang intervention group taking a leadership role when violence occurs, right? You might hear, well, yes, we're having a peace march. We're fighting against violence. But when it really comes down to solving violent crime and working with law enforcement, that's a very tenuous relationship. I've only seen it done effectively really in one place. Why? Because there is tremendous mistrust. There's mistrust. The gang interventionists don't trust the police, and the police don't trust the gang interventionists. Right? The gang interventionists say, if I talk to the police, I'm going to be seen as a snitch. And the police naturally are going to expect a level of cooperation in order to solve these crimes. So I do think that we have the resources available to try it differently, perhaps the New York approach. And that's not to say that there isn't some room for a gang injunction. And I'm not saying that I agree with it, because I think that gang injunctions are ineffective for the primary reason that they are used. And as I understood it, in San Francisco, the reason why the city attorney put the gang injunctions in place is to reduce violent crime. And the studies have showed that it's not effective at reducing violent crime, that violent crime simply gets displaced. In other words, if someone's going to take an AK-47 and go shoot somebody, they're going to do it irrespective of whether there's a gang injunction. The difference is, and, you know, I reached out to a couple of people, former gang members that I knew through my work, and I talked to them before coming here today. And I said, well, what do you guys think about the gang injunction? Do you think they work? And he said, yeah, you know who they work on? They work on the people who are the hardcore gang members. I said, well, why is that? Because they're always out there, and they don't like to get hassled by the police. And he said, what do? Well, they go to other places. So they're either, because they have no choice. They're going to do their gang-related activities, and they don't have the option of doing something else, or at least they don't feel they have the option. They also said that they felt that over half the people who were involved in gang or were named in gang injunctions were either people who were former gang members, or people who were leaving gangs, or people who were misidentified as gang members. And I have to talk about this a little bit later, because I know I have to sit down. But one thing I did see, and I represented people in the gang injunctions in San Francisco, is that there were people who were misnamed. And, you know, nobody's perfect. If you name 100 people, maybe 80% of them are going to be hardcore gang members and 20% are not. Well, as a public defender, I have to concern myself with that 20%. So as we go forward in this discussion, I just wanted to frame it in that way and talk about, you know, how gang injunctions are not, an ends into it itself. Whether it's a means to an end can be debated. What can't be debated is that we have a huge problem and we have to find new strategies to solve it.
Okay. So, Jeff, you brought up some very good issues in terms of your opposition, if I'm clear, to gang injunctions in theory, mm-hmm. because it is too far-reaching, perhaps. And in San Francisco, that seems to be the case because there are people who really shouldn't be part of the gang injunction.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to sound mealy-mouthed. I mean, what I'm saying is that if you're going to use a gang injunction, you have to be clear about what it's going to be used for. Has John been successful in getting the attention of the targets of the gang injunction? Absolutely, right? Has John been successful in bringing more attention to this problem in that community? Absolutely. You know, will the gang injunction ultimately save the next generation of young kids in Oakland from joining the gang? According to the studies, no.
And I want to kind of differentiate between the idea of preventing people from gathering in terms of a gang or a group, best practices, a group of lawyers, a group of, you know, gang members or people who want to associate with gang members, as opposed to violence and
right.
violence in a neighborhood. Because I think that one of the issues in the media, you know, and I now representing the media, I think we can enter kind of the slippery slope argument and then start to say gang injunctions don't work because they don't really stop people from gathering. But that's one argument. And then the other argument is gang injunctions don't work because they don't stop violence. And so which one do you think is really...
Well, gang injunctions do prohibit known gang members or people who are on the list from congregating together.
Right.
So that is the practical effect of the gang injunction. If you're seen in a gang injunction zone with another person on the list or someone who's a known gang member, you can be arrested and will be arrested for violating the terms of the injunction.
Right. In terms of outcome, I suppose, is what I'm trying to get at. In terms of arguing, the gang injunctions are effective or not effective.
Again, it depends on what the purpose of it is. If you're looking at the gang injunction to break up
groups of people from congregating in certain areas. That is something that the gang injunction will do.
Okay, let's turn to Attorney Russo. Is that the goal for Oakland, to stop people from congregating? And I will read a couple of things I got from the order itself. Restrictions include: do not associate with other enjoined gang members in public, do not confront, intimidate, or assault witnesses, do not possess firearms or dangerous weapons, stay away from drugs, no trespassing, no gang recruitment, follow time restrictions.
Yeah, I don't know why any of those would be controversial once we've proven, again, by clear and convincing evidence, that this individual is a nuisance to the community with a long track record and is unwilling to change their lives. I can't speak to San Francisco. I can speak only to Oakland. And what I can tell you is this: because we brought our injunction procedures against individuals, to determine whether or not the injunction is effective, you need look only at the track record of those individuals prior to the implementation of the injunction and then after. There's very little that Jeff had to say that I would disagree with. Like I said earlier, this is probably going to be more of a discussion than a debate. My notes here, which I use everywhere, is just one narrow tool to take power away from gangs and give it back to communities. Oakland spends more on intervention programs. We have a 2.5% Kids First set aside in our general fund, which goes toward youth programs that are by and large at-risk youth. We have a Measure Y surcharged property tax, which goes half to hiring additional police officers and half to yet another board to provide at-risk youth intervention services. I would never be one to argue that a gang injunction is a panacea alpha to omega to solve the problem that we have in Oakland. It's much deeper than that. But in the meantime, here are the facts. Since June, when the Northside Oakland injunction went into place, prior, in the 3 years approximately, three and a half years prior to the injunction going into place, the 15 specific individuals were arrested 67 times. These are all as adults, by the way. Nobody in Oakland is on the list unless they are on the list for crimes they committed as an adult. 67 adult arrests and 53 adult convictions, including armed robbery, carjacking, drug sales, car theft, felony drunk driving, reckless flight from police, carrying guns, grand theft, felony burglary, felony possession of narcotics, domestic battery, possession of an assault weapon, and many other gun crimes. In the 9 months since the injunction was put into place, we have had one arrest in the zone, and it was for a probation violation. The neighbors who were the impetus behind the Northside Oakland injunction, and let me tell you how it happened. We have this elaborate neighborhood crime prevention council apparatus in Oakland. Sometimes it works really well, sometimes it's bureaucracy. In North Oakland, it's particularly active. They started getting on their beat officers saying, why is it that all these other cities do gang injunctions, but this city won't do gang injunctions? Why can't you do something about NSO? So that's part of it came to the police. Police then brought it up to their brass. We had a new police chief. He said, why aren't you doing gang injunctions? And I said, because I'm worried about profiling and lawsuits, and we agreed to do it by individuals. The neighbors who brought us this pressure to do the injunction say, and it's not quantitative, I grant you it's qualitative, they say that many of the major drug markets are no longer in business in their community because NSO was the leading purveyor of illegal narcotics. And I don't say that, like I said, I'll probably annoy everybody in the room by the time I'm done. I don't say that as somebody who is a hardliner on illegal drugs. I mean, heck, there's 125 to 130 elected public law enforcement officials in California. Two endorsed Proposition 19. I'm one of them. So I think we need a complete reset on drug policy in general nationally, and I'm willing to stick my neck out politically in a way that most won't, even though they retire, then they say, yeah, you know, we think this is really foolish. It's like prohibition. Whatever your feelings on that, I'm not
sort of a down-the-line, red-meat, law-and-order guy. But the pragmatism, the pragmatic streak, the part of me that grew up in a tough neighborhood in Brooklyn, because you have in there that I went to Yale and everything, but
well,
that's not...
Well, I left out the
No,
Brooklyn
no, I know,
part.
But no, no, I'm not fussing about it. I just don't want people to think I was born with a silver spoon in my mouth. The part of me that grew up in a fairly tough dockside neighborhood, life is about pragmatism. It's not some lofty debate that takes place up in the air. It takes place on the street. When people are shot in these drive-bys, innocent bystanders and young men who are in the wrong life, this is real blood, real death. This is not a coffee house conversation between, you know, who's right on a particular esoteric issue. So I look at it pragmatically. The Oakland injunction and the North Oakland injunction has been extremely effective so far. And yes, there is a lot of validity to Jeff's argument that in some cases it's like pushing down the bump in the rug and then the bump comes up somewhere else. That's true. But by that argument, we almost should do nothing from an enforcement perspective. We're here to disrupt ongoing criminal enterprises and keep them on the run and disrupt their work. We know it's not the be-all and end-all, but we know it's made things better in North Oakland in the last 9 months.
And that's what I wanted to kind of focus on. There is a safety zone in North Oakland. It covers a certain area. You have mentioned that the numbers are down in terms of violence. I see here in 2007, there were 3 NSO-related incidents involving murder, shooting, or gun possession. 2008, the number rose to 7. In 2009, that escalated to 18. So you're saying those numbers are down.
NSO-related is seriously down, and the number of drug arrests that OPD has done in North Oakland is down 70% since the NSO injunction. Now, there are other numbers that have gone up in terms of crime, and those who argue against the injunction say, well, crime's gone up in the safety zone. And my argument to that is that's an ivory tower argument because you don't get a parallel universe where there was no injunction. You don't know how much crime might have gone up had the injunction not been in place. There's no way to hold you harmless for that kind of experiment. People are not guinea pigs. They're not little ant farms that we shake up to see what happens. The question is, what happened with these 15 guys? Are they now stopping from acting to terrorize the community in that neighborhood? Yes. Ergo, we win.
What about...
It's good.
What about the argument that they're coming right outside that safety zone, they're going into other people's neighborhoods, and they're creating mayhem that way?
That's a theoretical argument. We have no data that proves that or shows that or that indicates that. None at all. Two of these guys have been arrested outside the safety zone, one for a probation violation. Tullis was arrested in Hayward for carrying a gun, and then we had another guy who... We had another fellow who led people on an amazing high-speed chase down San Pablo Avenue. This was a guy who went on TV clipping his hedges, telling a reporter, I don't know why they have me on the list. I'm not a bad guy. I don't have anything to do with Northside Oakland, blah, blah, blah. And then he goes on some crazy chase on San Pablo, going 85 miles an hour, jumps the median, almost kills a bunch of people, crashes his car, runs out, throws a gun into the bushes. Luckily, because he'd probably have lawyers say that we planted the gun on him, but the ammo that matched the gun was in the car still, and it was traced back as a stolen gun in Brentwood, and he's in the pokey again, too. But he was just outside the zone. But that's because he started the chase in the zone. He ended up getting caught outside the zone.
Public defender Adachi. John Russo has talked a great deal about specifics in terms of effectiveness, in terms of it actually working in the safety zone, in terms of going after certain individuals and seeing that they're not committing the crimes that they were committing just years before. How do you address that?
Well, you know, it's very hard to measure the outcome of these gang injunctions. One of the things that I tried to do when we put the gang injunctions in place in San Francisco is to monitor, you know, not only whether or not there was more crime in a particular area, but what the crime was outside that area. You might have seen a recent report that came out of the police department that talked about, this is South San Francisco, talked about the fact that crime from San Francisco is being displaced into South San Francisco. And, you know, I don't know what the basis of the statement was, but essentially law enforcement in South San Francisco were saying, hey, this is a result of the gang injunctions in San Francisco because people are moving their businesses out of the city. And that may be a good thing. Maybe that's what you want. You want people to move out of your city and move, you know, somewhere else. And if the goal is to displace a group of people to another area, or as John said, chase them, then certainly you can have that effect by utilizing a gang injunction, but you're not ultimately reducing violent crime or reducing crime in general. You know, the stats that John mentioned, I think you got to look at arrests. I think you got to look beyond that and also what crimes were reported. I know that Oakland lost what percentage?
We lost a lot of officers.
Right.
For those of you who follow the papers, we have an administration with which I am in deep disagreement about how to handle our budget and how to handle our core services and what constitutes a core service. And we've laid off a lot of officers.
But I
80, had re- 80 yeah. out of 750, I think.
And I had read that the impact that has had on arrest. Now, I'm not saying that that's connected to, you know, the either non-reporting or, you know, low arrest record with respect to these individuals. I don't know that, but I think that's something that would have to be, you know, looked at as well. Unquestionably, you could have a gang injunction which has the effect of reducing crime in a particular neighborhood. You know, especially if you're talking about a fairly identifiable small group. But if you look at the data overall and you take a look at, for example, what we've seen with the numbers in Los Angeles, it's just the opposite, that you actually see an increase in gang-related crime. And it's not to say that an increase in gang-related crime is caused by a gang injunction. I don't think that makes any sense. But you can't make the inverse argument that just because you have a gang injunction, you're going to see a reduction in gang-related crime. There's just one thing I wanted to mention. I had read an article in the LA Times about a South Central neighborhood right next to Watts that saw a 50% drop in killings. And they quoted the captain of that precinct, and he said that he had taken a new strategy working with ex-gang members to prevent violence. This is a very sort of controversial thing. And rather than to try to suppress violence entirely, what they did is they really focused on flare-ups and retaliatory violence. And they were able to reduce crime by 50%. This is one of the most violent precincts or districts in Los Angeles. So, again, when you're looking at reductions, you have to look at all of the factors that affect whether it's the number of police, you know, amount of resources that are put into a particular area, prosecutorial resources, all those things need to be considered, including social services and gang intervention efforts.
Thank you. If we look at Los Angeles, for example, you know, and saying that the numbers are up, and so therefore gang injunctions might not really be effective, I mean, don't we also have to take into consideration the factor of criminal activity itself, and you know, if you look back at the 80s and you look at things like crack, cocaine, there was an increase to gang activity. So there are factors beyond the control of a particular tool that a law enforcement...
Yeah, and just so it's clear, I'm not saying that because there are more gang members in L.A. today than there were in 1987... gang injunctions don't work.
Okay.
I mean,
let me then do a kind of a, let's see if we're all on the same page and then maybe we can talk. And also I would like to open up to questions. But I am hearing that gang injunctions can work if implemented effectively, fairly. Is that true?
Okay. You have to understand that the process... And in John's case is somewhat of an exception because I think all the people you named in the injunction have lawyers. Is that right?
Nearly all of them do. Not all of them do, but we were outnumbered 3 lawyers to 1 on the North Oakland injunction.
And that's the story today in the Chronicle. Not that I'm selling it because I used to work there, but there is a story that talks about the legal fees. And in fact, if you could talk about, I think I read it was $731,000.
That's
that
a
Oakland,
bogus number.
No, okay.
Yeah. I'll be happy to dissect it, but did you want to stick with Jeff?
Yeah. I mean, just to give an example, when they did it in San Francisco, there were a number of people that were named. And again, yes, there were hardcore gang members that were named in the gang injunction. Most of them didn't show up. The ones that tended to show up were the ones who, had very minimal criminal histories. There was one woman who had absolutely no present involvement in gang, but had been involved in gangs 2 years ago. And so the information that they used to say she was a gang member was outmoded. We were able to get her off the gang injunction. I represented another young man whose only tie to gang activity, and some of you may disagree with this, was the fact that he rapped about the Norteño gang. And they used that the song that he, you know, in the song, he's talking about being a Norteño. So I guess it could be an admission. But he was just rapping about it. And based on that alone, he had no criminal history, no prior, had never been arrested for a crime before, had been seen in the presence of other supposed gang members, but had nothing more than that. And so we undertook to represent him, brought his case to court. Ultimately, he was found not to be on the list. You know, it took several thousand dollars. It took about a month of litigation going back and forth. Ultimately, that was the result. You know, does he think it was fair? No, because he doesn't think that he should have been on there at all. So when you talk about fairness, you got to make sure that if you're going to be categorizing people as gang members, that you have objective criteria. What I ended up doing is I took the San Francisco Police Department factors relating to 186.22 of the Penal Code, what defines a gang member, and I used those to disprove that he was a gang member. And so one of the things that I advocated for was to use that list of criteria that was already in use by the police department to apply to individuals who were named in the gang injunctions. The other thing I think that you have to have is you have to have a full investigation of harassment and racial profiling. I know those may not be popular words here, but it does happen. It does happen. One of the people I talked to before coming here talked about is not the effect that the gang injunction has on the people who are named in the injunction, but everybody else. And he was telling me through anecdotal information about what people are experiencing in Oakland. And I don't know how widespread it is. And, you know, it's not necessarily documented in a way that you would be able to say, yes, this is happening, or no, it isn't. But that's certainly collateral damage that comes. And what he was saying is that police were using the gang injunction to stop people, ask people whether they were on the gang injunction. We had the same experience here in San Francisco.
And that, in fact, is the case happening in Los Angeles. A quick scan of YouTube videos, lots and lots of videos out there. So I did have a chance to see a number of them. And in fact, police officers in Los Angeles were stopping groups of people and asking questions using the gang injunction to ask, hey, why are you here? And there were children and there were women, and the group started to say, well, you know, we can gather. I mean, we can be here. This is a public park. And yet the police did continue to in a sense, harass them. So, John, do you want to address that?
Yeah, we don't do that in Oakland. If they're not on the injunction list, the police don't stop you for the injunction. If they stop you for something else because they have probable cause, that's a different issue. But our police don't do that. They're trained not to use the injunction except against, at this point, there's only 15 individuals in Oakland who are subject to the injunction. It's in the North Oakland area.
So, John, now, you don't think anyone has been racially profiled or stopped without a reason in Oakland?
Oh, I'm not saying nobody got stopped or profiled in Oakland. That's part of why we're doing it the way we're doing it, because I don't want the lawsuits if that does happen. I don't want to vest that kind of discretion in a department that's had so much turmoil over the past several years. I mean, you know, we're under the Riders matter from 8-9 years ago. We're still under supervision of a federal court. So the last thing I want to do is go in with an L.A. style, which may or may not be appropriate to L.A. I'm not criticizing one way or the other. that would not be appropriate in Oakland right now, given where we are and given the politics of Oakland. I don't think most people who are like me, who by Bay Area standards are moderate, I don't think most people like me would want a broad gang injunction in Oakland. But when you do it individual by individual and the police aren't stopping folks, I can tell you that the opponents of the gang injunction are making claims that folks in the Fruitvale neighborhood are being impacted already by the police with the gang injunction. We haven't even finished our hearing yet. And by the way, I was texted, if you saw, I was looking. We've had 6 days of hearings and 4 days with case management conferences thus far on the 40 guys in the Norteño's injunction. Let me quickly address this bogus 730, whatever.
Sorry, 761,120.
Yeah, 7 million, 25 million, whatever. Here's what that represents. That represents the time that the police officers took to put together the dossiers and to do their work to get ready for each individual's clear and convincing hearing under the injunction. It does not represent new money. New money for 55 cases, because there are 40 Norteños, 15 NSO, 55 cases. The outside counsel bill is $110,000 up to now, and those are with caps, so they're not going to go over 110. Okay. $110,000. Unless you want to start counting my time, which we all bill, like we're a private law firm, if you start counting my lawyer's time, but they're all lawyers in the police unit, so is the alternative is we'll be doing police work. It'll be chasing behind murders, chasing behind after-the-fact problems generated in large part by these known criminal enterprises. So to say it's 700, what's the number they're saying now?
761,000.
Changes every time I hear it. $761,000, let's assume that number is right for the purposes of argument, that that represents the city's investment in these 55 cases. It works out to about $15,000 a case. Most of you out here are lawyers. How many cases you think can get done for $15,000? Not a lot. Not a lot. If we, and that goes without talking about how much it costs when we have a drive-by shooting, how many resources go in at all levels of government to process, and I hate to use that word when we're dealing with a human life, but to process that homicide is well in advance of that kind of number, putting aside the real human loss and drama and mourning and upset and disruption that goes on and fear. Here's what I think is interesting, Jeff. I'm not directing this at you, but here's what I think is interesting about the profiling issue. At least in Oakland, again, I can't speak to San Francisco. The person who's leading the StopTheInjunction.org website is a woman from Santa Rosa. When you read chronicled stories about who's protesting, it's people from other cities who are coming into Oakland like they come into Oakland to do their dirty work. When a tragedy happens like Oscar Grant, you get a bunch of wacky white guys who come in and decide they're going to protest against racism by smashing the windows of the African-American lady who has the braid store. I'm not smart enough to follow how the white guy from Berkeley smashes her windows to show he's pissed off about racism. That's absurd. So when you look at that, and you look at who's against the injunction, of course there are people now in the Fruitvale who are scared of the injunction because, among other things, you've got knucklehead lawyers, like one of the lawyers who's in court fighting us, who went to Fremont High School with a bullhorn and stood outside the school and told the kids through a bullhorn, when he thought, I guess, he'd seen the movie Milk or something and thought he was organizing the new revolution, he pulled out a bullhorn and he said, the police chief and the city attorney want to criminalize you because of the color of your skin and the fact that you're young. And we have to go to court and tell the judge that we won't stand for it. So when you look at the protests, it's a bunch of young people who have been lied to, because they're not on the list. They can't be on the list. They would never be on the Oakland list. But you have adults, and I've taught my sons, I have 12-year-old twins, I've taught them from when they were little. Whenever an adult says it's all about the children, it's actually all about the adults, and they're about to use the kids to make an ideological point. That's what's going on here. I mean, the people who are frightened in the Fruitville are not frightened because of any reality of what we're trying to do. The people who are frightened because they've been lied to by a bunch of ideologues who think that they're going to kick off the Great General Strike of 2011 through the gang injunction opposition. And it's a fantasy, and it's a shame that it's happened that way because that's not right. I don't see how we find justice through lying to children. And that's what, and again, Jeff, this is not, you know, this is not directed at you at all, okay? But it does agitate me when people fib and when they know better.
Yeah, I just wanted to make one comment on, you know, if somebody has committed murder or carjacking or rape or any of the other crimes that you listed, they shouldn't be just enjoined in a gang injunction. They ought to be prosecuted.
Mm-hmm.
And we have laws to prosecute individuals who commit those kinds of crimes. And we have a system that works sometimes and doesn't work other times. But it's a system we have. And that system exists to determine whether or not a person is guilty of the crime beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's what should happen to people who are involved in committing serious crime.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just to separate out, that because you have serious crime occurring in these communities, gang injunctions are necessarily justified.
Except that we don't wait for the guy to kill his ex-girlfriend before we grant a restraining order against him being within so many feet of her. The law does recognize through the civil courts restraining orders, and I see these gang injunctions as being in the manner of a restraining order. And I couldn't, I mean, there's nothing you've said about the concerns around profiling on the fly that I can disagree with. That's why we do them the way we do them in Oakland. Fun fact, though, is that of the 40 men that we've named in the Fruitvale injunction since October, while we're going through this extensive process, which we agree with, of those 40, 14 have been arrested or convicted for new crimes since we filed, including an attempted murder where a kid was shot in the leg because the fella in the car, who was the targeter, one of our guys, believed that he was a member of the Border Brothers gang. And I can't speak to San Francisco. I've got blinders on for Oakland. But we have a war going on between the Norteños, the Sureños, and the Border Brothers. And these guys, they're young men, mostly in their mid to late 20s. They're killing each other. And so we're hoping through the gang injunction to break up these patterns to give them an opportunity to maybe get out. Because if you're in the more traditional gang, there is a set of commitments. Like I said, it's almost like a catechism.
Yeah,
I say that as a former Catholic and being here at USF. It's like a catechism.
Yeah.
You know, you've taken your oath. You've been confirmed. And so this is a way, perhaps, to break those patterns and give them a second chance. And that's why we have the opt-out process that we have. That's why we have all the programs we have.
You know, one question that I would have is when you have a gang injunction against one gang, say the Norteños, and you don't have a gang injunction against the Sureños, does that create a inequality in the power of each respective gangs? And how does that influence the balance of power between those two gangs, if at all?
The Norteños are by far the largest and the longest running show in gangs in Oakland. They claim themselves, I mean, because they're all over the social networking sites, and there's been documentaries done about them. They claim they've been active in Oakland since 1973. The Oakland Police Department believes there are approximately 400 members of the Norteños gang. We've only named 40 because I only want those cases I'm sure we can prove. That's why we went 15 for 15 on Northside Oakland, even though the police believe there's about 45 to 55 members. I only took the ones we could take. One last point. You're absolutely right. If you go against the Norteños in their turf and not the Sureños or Border Brothers in their turf, you could have an inequality. I have no answer for that argument. I just don't have the resources to do more, so we're going against the worst group and the worst within the worst that we're concerned about. Of course, the really worst are already in prison, but these are the next level of guys, and that's who we're going after. One last point. We started with 42. I dropped two out of the list. Our original list was 42, and this goes to the comment you were making earlier, which is legit. There is sometimes a tendency to put people in who may have moved on. And we had one young fellow who came to our press conference and said, "You got me wrong. here's my grades, I've got a job. So what I did was I just called his employer. And his employer sent a letter saying he's really turning his life around, and I vouch for him. We said, okay, fine, we take you off the list. Go in peace, and blessings upon you. And the other guy, I think he's still a gang member, but I didn't feel our evidence was strong enough to prevail by clear and convincing, so we dropped him. And it's kind of like prosecutorial discretion.
Right, in the Oakland injunction, anyone on the list who is no longer associated with the gang will be able to go through, quote, an opt-out process. Gang injunctions were upheld as constitutional by California Supreme Court in 97. Do you have any response real quick? And then I kind of want to open it up. Also, I want to make a kind of, understanding being an advisory board member of this institute, I know that everyone here, you're really, the group that you're talking to, they're leaders of leaders. In a sense, they are making decisions at police departments, law enforcement agencies, and they're deciding things like, should we do more gang injunctions? Should we not do the gang injunctions? Where should we come? Should we look at it as a broad spectrum, as an effective tool? Jeff, if I could start with you in really addressing the audience and the group here on what they might want to do as we go into the future about gang injunctions, then I'll turn it over to John.
Well, gang injunctions are, I'd hate to say a fact of life, but in a sense, if a gang injunction is brought, unless the United States Supreme Court rules differently, it's going to be found to be legal. Now, you can have an opt-out process. You can do a lot of things to ensure that people who shouldn't be on that list are not on that list. One of the things is that there has to be objective criteria for gang membership. I mentioned that earlier. But I just briefly want to mention some of the other things that often aren't looked at in conjunction with a gang injunction. And that is that at some point we have to establish a relationship between law enforcement and people who do gang intervention work. Now, I know that's controversial because, you hear stories about things that have blown up and have not worked, and that you have to make sure that the folks that you're entrusting as law enforcement to have some relationship with aren't going to burn you and that they're going to do what they say they're going to do. And likewise, they have to feel the same way about you, that you're not going to burn them. That if they give you information that they want you to use to help eliminate the possibility of retaliation, then it has to be used for that purpose and not any other purpose. And those are hard agreements to come upon. There is no model to have an MOU between law enforcement and gang interventionists who are effective. There is no model as to how a gang interventionist should do their work. Right, you've seen the programs out of Chicago, you've seen the programs out of Boston. They've been writing about these programs for many, many years. There needs to be a better, more clearly defined relationship between those who work with gang members and those who are truly committed to helping people turn their lives around. I know a group called the United Players here in San Francisco, and you may have a different view, but I feel that they are a genuine group that is dedicated to reducing violence by offering an alternative to kids who are in gangs. United Players is, in many sense, like a gang, except they engage in the good, not the bad. They offer the same thing. They offer, the same almost family environment to kids in the Tenderloin. They provide, resources. They, all the things that you would want your kid to have, they try to provide to their kids on limited resources. They're an effective program. Are they going to grow into an organization that can work effectively with law enforcement? I don't know. There is no model for that, and there needs to be. Finally, I do think that we have to provide jobs and training, whether that's life skills, anger management, to those individuals who are either about to join gangs or are peripherally involved in gangs. Even hardcore gang members can turn their lives around. We have seen that. Obviously, you get somebody who's totally committed to a life in gangs, you're probably not going to turn that person around. But we've got to be able to interface with people earlier on. Otherwise, we're constantly going to be fighting the same battle 50 years from now. Well, it won't be John Russo, but whoever's there is still going to be fighting for gang injunctions, and we don't want that.
I don't have any broad advice. I really don't. I think it's a case-by-case basis. What may work in Oakland is not appropriate in another city. I don't think there's any, like I said at the beginning, I don't see it as a panacea. This is not the banner I'm marching under. This is a tool in the toolbox. If you have a community in which people are terrorized by an organized group of folks who are committing illegal activities and burglarizing businesses, and they're all organized and working together, then you might want to consider a gang injunction. I'm a firm believer in the way we're doing it in Oakland because of my concerns that you should balance public safety with civil liberties. During the Ryder's case, I got a lot of criticism from the law enforcement side because most of the guys who were plaintiffs in the Ryder's case were, a lot of them had long criminal records. And my comment then, which I probably shouldn't have said, and I probably shouldn't even say it now, is, well, even scumbags have constitutional rights, and we have to obey them. And it's really important that we do that. It's super important to who we are. And I believe in that. Even it's easy to believe in it when, if law enforcement gets something wrong, then it's very easy to say, wow, look at how bad the situation is. What's really hard is to stand up for civil liberties when law enforcement gets the right guy, but in the wrong way or for the wrong reason, because people don't want to hear it. They want to say, oh, it's a technicality, it's a legality, it's lawyers' tricks. But those processes, to me at least, are super important. I believe they're very important to most Oaklanders, and that's why we're doing the injunction the way we are in Oakland. That may not be the way an inland empire city may decide to deal with a gang problem, and I'm not going to judge the decisions they make through their democratically elected and appointed officials. It's not for me to judge that. We do know that the Supreme Court in California has upheld gang injunctions, the broad kind of gang injunction, as constitutional. So,
thank you. I'd like to open up to questions now. If any of you have questions, we have a microphone here. So, anybody?
Yay!
I know.
Boo!
I think. Yeah. And if you could introduce yourself and from where, which?
Hi, I'm John Ehrlich. I've been dealing with gangs since the '80s, the Latin gangs in the Outer Mission in the '80s. And in the Western Addition, where they did a gang injunction. And part of what I don't see in the discussion is you talk about hardcore people that are joining the gangs. They're in a neighborhood, and when you take them out of the neighborhood, because we introduced the gang injunction, a lot of preparation, these guys moved to the Tenderloin. But what happened was they did not have the infrastructure. They didn't have their parents, their friends, their neighbors to wreak havoc on the neighborhood, to terrorize the whole community. Now, they went to the Tenderloin, and they still dealt drugs, and they tried to do stuff, but their impact was greatly, greatly reduced in what they could do because they didn't have the infrastructure to do all these things. Also, what you had in any gang, you have the leaders, and you have the shooters, and then you have guys hanging around who are often victims, who are often in the cars when the shooters are killing people, and they're going to prison, too. So sometimes by placing a gang injunction, you can help not just the hardcore guys. They're going to find their way to prison unless they turn their life around, which usually happens when they get caught. But for the other people who are hanging on because they're their friends, they grew up with them, you provide a way to get them out of the environment. And what's so bad with being in a gang injunction? I'm trying to figure it out. You can't hang out with gang members. You can't hang out after 10 o'clock at night. It shouldn't change your life so badly that you can't continue all doing all the legitimate things that most of us do. It simply prohibits you from doing things that you shouldn't be doing. And for even the people that aren't hardcore gang members, it provides a way out. So I'm looking at the debate that's going on here and going, really, it doesn't, the other side seems pretty weak, and all these people stand up saying, well, you said, oh, this guy, he was merely hanging out with gang members and was their spokesman. He didn't belong in there. I disagree. He hadn't yet gone to the point where he was criminally liable. Great, let's get him out of there so he doesn't get to that point. Let's keep him out of the criminal justice system, not get him out and do a rehabilitation. Put him in. Okay, now you can't associate with the gang members anymore. You can't rap about them and glorify them and get other people in. I don't think that's bad. So it's not really a question. It's more like a statement of what I've seen with the gang members. And the injunctions, we were having regular homicides in the Western Addition. They've dropped to almost zero. And what's happened is, of course, it's not going to stop future gang members and the juveniles who are gang members. It's not going to stop them. I think juveniles should be included. The point is to keep them from the point where they're going to go to prison. And by including them early on, you might provide that way out.
Jeff.
Yeah, I mean, those are all good points. I think, though, you know, we haven't found a good way to predict who's going to commit crime. I mean, you can look at certain factors, and, I mean, one way to prevent crime is just to lock people up, and that hasn't worked. I mean, you know, the amount of money that we're spending on our prisons and, you know, that whole debate, you know, is one that I'm sure all of us wish we weren't having. You know, the idea of a person moving to another neighborhood and taking up criminal activities there, again, may bring some solace to the neighborhood that they left, but not, you know, to the neighborhood that they moved to. I mean, it's kind of like, what's that movie, Escape from New York, where you just have an area of town that becomes the place where gang members reside, where there are no injunctions, and that happens to be the Tenderloin now.
Any other questions? All right. I want to thank my guests, Jeff Adachi, Public Defender of San Francisco, and John Russo, Oakland City Attorney.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tony.
Okay, thanks. Swag.